My name is Tom Witt, and this session is titled something about enemies. I forget what it is now. How we get them.
What do you do with them?
That's the part you really want to know about, right?
Yeah, right.
What do you do with them? I'm going to try to spend about half the time on how we get them, and toward the second half, talk about what we might do with them. But I really think it's important that we start with how we get them, because that has something to do with what we do with them. So, and I'm just to say that I'm going to be talking in and out of the personal level into the national and international level, and I hope that you feel comfortable with that, because we have enemies on both levels. And I think that we can learn from our interpersonal relations about how we deal with national and international enemies and vice versa. So we'll be weaving that in and out, and please feel free to bring up questions and comments and insights on both levels. I want to start just by saying that I think it is important to talk about enemies first. I work for a peace organization, and I think it's really important to talk about enemies, because when we talk about being a peacemaker, obviously the difficult part of being a peacemaker is when one is confronted by one's enemy. It's not so difficult to be a peacemaker if everyone you're associated with is your friend, or you like them or they like you. So the difficulty becomes when you clash with someone else who begins to despise you, or when someone threatens the values that you live for, when someone attacks you either physically or verbally. That's when it's difficult to become a peacemaker. And as I said, it's true for individuals as well as nations. And we used to think that in the peace movement you could just simply start talking about nuclear weapons and how many we needed, and whether Star Wars was right, and whether we could let our defenses down, whether it's immoral to kill or not to kill. Those are really important questions, but they're not the only questions, and maybe not the first questions, because I think in the beginning we create the enemy. Before the weapons happen, before the arms race, before the handguns, before the sharp words are spoken, before all of that happens comes the image of the enemy. We begin to hate, and we think others to death, and then we invent the implements with which to do that. So first comes the image of enemy, and then comes all the ways in which we, whatever it is, the battle axe or the ballistic missile or the abuse of action that ends up harming people. And I think we get this backwards sometimes. We assume that the enemy will vanish if only we manage our weapons differently. And this is conservatives and liberals alike. Conservatives think that the enemy will be frightened into civility if we just have bigger and better weapons, and liberals tend to think that the enemy will become our friend if we have smaller and fewer weapons. Both of those proceed from the rational assumption that we are reasonable and pragmatic people. And I'm not sure that we are. I don't think that we can necessarily get to peacemaking just through rational negotiations and arms control. The problem sometimes lies in our own hearts, not necessarily in our technology, but in the hardness of our hearts and the way we build enemies and hate each other's enemies. I think the best hope for our survival is to look a little deeper into the way we think about enemies and about warfare, and that becomes the key. How do enemies become enemies? Let's look at the eyes with which we see those enemies. So that's what I want to do today. I don't think we'll become very good peacemakers unless we learn a little bit about that and how they're created and perpetuated. The way I want to start is for you just to do a little bit of maybe guided meditation is the word. I'd like for you to either close your eyes, or if you have pen and a piece of paper, you can do some writing. If you don't have that, don't worry about it. But I'm just going to guide you a little bit through some meditation. My assumption here is, or my hope here is, that you all have enemies. I really believe that on some level we all have enemies, and I want us to just clarify individually who those people are for us. So just sit quietly, and this will take maybe 5 minutes, and I'll just guide you through some thinking. If you have pens, you can do some writing. Otherwise, just think of the names of your enemies. I want you to name specific persons or sorts of persons you dislike and whose company you avoid. Name specific persons or sorts of persons you dislike and whose company you avoid. Think about individuals it distresses you to see, perhaps in your own family, in your neighborhood, or where you work. Think about individuals who have hurt you or hurt those in your care. Now switch gears a little bit. I want you to think about categories of people that are defined by racial, religious, sexual, economic, or national labels. Think of categories of people who are defined by racial, religious, sexual, economic, or national labels. Think of nations or groups of people who are the current or potential targets of our violence. And forces that in some way you support, either passively or actively. Think of people who are current or potential targets of our weapons or forces or violence. Think of people, either individuals or groups of people, who might have been enemies at one time, but who no longer are. I'd like for you to go through your list of names or group labels. Even if you're hesitant to call these enemies, think about each name or label. And in each case, picture faces or images. Describe your enemies. What do they look like? And what do you know about them? Now go back to the beginning of your written or your mental list and consider in each case how the enmity began. Was it their fault? Was it your fault? Consider incidents or reasons that justify your feelings. Finally, take the point of view of those you have listed. Are they actually your enemies? Or are there cases in which there are grounds for some doubt? From their perspective, what might you have done that would justify their hostility? Take a few moments now, can come back to this world here, and I don't know if anyone feels comfortable sharing. I certainly don't want to demand or ask that you do that, but if anyone had a really, really strong image of an enemy that they want to share, I'm willing to hear that. It won't take too much. Either, do you have one?
You want what I saw?
Yeah, just, sure.
Well, it's so startling because when I looked at the enemy as one person, everything changed. The enemy that I'd written down other qualities for initially, when I looked at it as one person, I wrote down insecure, hurting, pressured by cultural expectations, repressed feelings, and shaped by a legalistic religious outlook.
Hmm. And you had not done that kind of exercise before you looked into
it? I had all these negative things, boastful, hypercritical, judgmental, when I was looking at the enemy, and only you said one person.
Thank you, that's really helpful. Does anyone have anyone personally that really is fearful of someone that really wants to do you in, or someone who wants to do you harm? I've done this a couple of times, and there's sometimes been one or two people that really have someone that they're frightened of. You don't necessarily have to talk about that, but I know that's a reality for some people, especially women. What about national and international? Were there groups of people that came to mind that either are enemies now or used to be? Let's just call them out. What did you think of?
Well, certainly Germany and Japan.
Germany, Japan. Well, that shows your age.
Never mind.
Just think of all the people who are involved in all the drug dealing and the
drug dealers, okay. Okay.
I thought of the country that is holding our hostages, Lebanon,
Iran. Mm-hmm. Okay. Others?
I thought of Mauritania.
Mauritania. Okay.
They're not our enemies. They're Black African
Native Americans.
Okay. What about nicknames for any of these people? I know that's one of the ways in which we think of enemies, that, you know, the Japanese were Japs, and we had the Gooks and the Commies, and it's another way in which we label enemies. Are there any of those that came to mind?
Spick. People in the South still call a Black person Negro. Nigger.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Okay, thanks. This is helpful just to get us started. Obviously, one of my premises this morning is that we do create enemies. And you may say, wait a minute, enemies aren't created. We don't make enemies. They're just out there. There are evil people in the world. There are aggressors. There's evil empires. There are bad men and wicked women. And they will destroy us if we don't destroy them first. They're just our real villains out there, the Hitlers, the Stalins, etc. And I want to, first of all, agree with that and say, in part, enemies and the accompanying hostility, which we call enmity, can begin simply with brutality without provocation. That there are dangerous people in the world who will simply strike out for no particular reason, and that we need to be aware of that. I'm also making the case that that's only one way in which enemies become enemies, and although sheer brutality may play a role in enmity, it's not the single cause of enmity. And I make a case that most enmity doesn't arise unilaterally, but many times enemies are created simply because of a conflict. Both sides wanting something and considering each other's obstacles to getting what they want, and both or one of us wants to win badly enough that we're willing to hurt the other person. The simplest example of that would be two children reaching for the same piece of pie. Now, if you want a complicated sociological definition of that, the sociologists would call this a conflict over resource scarcity, in which the supply of pie is limited so that both children can't have all they want. In other contexts, there would be position scarcity, where two adults are reaching for the same position at work, or two teams battling for the same championship. If that kind of conflict happens within agreed upon limits, we call it competition. It's okay, it's healthy. If it breaks out of those limits, it becomes a serious conflict where enemies can be created. Two children who want the same piece of pie, or the two adults who want the same job, need not become enemies, but they can become enemies. So
even, it's not even the conflict that happens that creates enemies, it's the way in which the conflict is waged. It's the way in which enmity is created during the conflict. And regardless of the type of conflict, usually something happens in one's mind to build the conflict into enmity. Enmity many times is in the eye of the beholder. Let me give you one example. Let's say that I was walking down the street at night in downtown Seattle, and I spot a scowling young man across the street, and I immediately think that he might mug me. And I perhaps have good reason to believe that. I've read something in the newspaper where this happened recently. So I'm on my guard, I'm looking around for help, thinking that how I might outmaneuver this guy, and all of a sudden he starts across the street towards me. And actually, he only wants to ask me for directions, but and he's not really my enemy, but I think he is. So I take preventative measures, and I pull out my switchblade. Now, his real intention will never become clear. I think, hey, that guy's... the guy is thinking, hey, this guy is pointing a knife at me. I better take it away from him before someone gets hurt. That's what he's thinking about me. So he attacks me. So the hostility that I only imagine now has become real. Now that's a rather unrealistic, perhaps, example of what actually happens on streets at night, but I think that that kind of thing happens more often than we think. It's an example of a way that enemies are created through projection. I just want to write some of these ways down here that enemies are created. Projection is when one side, without sufficient evidence, imagines that the other side is hostile. And as I said, this is pretty common, to project an unpleasant experience onto others and then dislike them for that characteristic. Has anyone ever done that? I'll tell you when I'll be the first to share this. I'll tell you when I do this the most is when I'm driving. And someone changes lanes without turning on their blinker, cuts me off. Don't ever cut me off when I'm driving. And it's particularly good if I can't see the person's face, or if this person is driving a car that's nicer than mine, if they're rich with a really expensive car, I can get quite angry at them and project onto them all sorts of characteristics. Sometimes we do this when we're unable to come to terms with some weakness in ourselves. If I'm greedy, I keep an eye out for hints of greediness in other people, and then I despise them for it. Or if I'm aggressive, if I tend to be aggressive, I can recognize right away signs of aggressive behavior in other people and then denounce them for the cruelty that I can't face in myself. If I'm a worker, a carpenter, and something goes wrong, I can blame my tools rather than myself. Or if this session doesn't go well, I'm going to blame you folks. I had a lousy group today. It wasn't my fault. But it's a common way to deal with our shortcomings, that we're comfortable when something's not right, and instead of searching within ourselves, we voice it off on somebody else. And this is where scapegoats come from. And I'm sure that we've all experienced this. If you've been somewhere at home or the office, and someone else comes in angry from a previous argument and lashes out at you, they've shifted their anger from the earlier incident. And what I want to point out is this happens on the national level too. I said I was going to weave in some of this. In the 1920s, for instance, when many Germans were very upset over their deteriorating economy and the huge reparations that they had to pay after the First World War, they began accusing communists and then later Jews for causing their problems. And this is really one of the beginning signs of the Holocaust, that was Jews were a scapegoat for the problems that Germany was experiencing. Ronald Reagan did this in 1983, if you remember, when he called the Soviet Union the source of all evil in the world, the source of all problems. You project bad things onto the enemy, and then we only see and acknowledge those negative aspects of the enemy, and those support our image that we've already created.
I think we did this a lot in the United States during the last 40 years, especially with the Soviet Union. It's interesting now in the last year how that has changed. I left Minneapolis on Saturday, and Gorbachev was coming to Minneapolis on Sunday, and I've never seen such a preparation for a hero in my life. And just a couple of years ago, it would have been vastly different. And I'm not saying that the United States is the only nation that does this. I've been to the Soviet Union a number of times, and once when I was introducing myself to some people and said that I originally grew up in Chicago, they said, "Oh, Al Capone." And that was the only thing that they knew about Chicago was Al Capone. So obviously there's ways in which other people's, especially the media, what we see is always the bad news and vice versa. Sometimes when we move beyond what is accurate and into something else, there's a term that I like to use, and it's just called enemy thinking. And often we move into this kind of mindset when we're overly suspicious of people, if we doubt their integrity, if we believe without a lot of evidence that they're out to get us, then I think we're indulging in what's called enemy thinking. And on a personal level, this can happen when if a single remark by someone quickly becomes a personal affront, then we're enemy thinking. And it's usually because I'm insecure myself. Or if we say that someone's motives are disreputable, when they do something we don't approve of, we might be enemy thinking. If my neighbor builds a fence and I say, "Oh, well, they just want to keep me out," I'm really enemy thinking if what they really want to do is just keep their dogs in their yard. I think we do that quite a bit. We move away from what's completely accurate. Stereotyping is another form, can turn into a form of enemy thinking. Stereotyping is when we attribute to all people in a particular category the unpleasant characteristics that may be found in a few. Poor people are lazy, or rich people are greedy, or Latin Americans are violent, or old people are of no use to society, or singles aren't whole people, or after one meal at Holden, you think all vegetarian food is boring. Or after just 1 week of Dan Erlinder session, you think Bible study is boring. I mean, those are the kinds of stereotypes that we can get into. It's easiest to do this kind of projecting with unfamiliar people. It's the stranger that receives the most hostility from us. It's really true that when strangers speak a foreign language or wear odd clothes, have a different appearance, we begin to act in fear, like that man at night on the street, because he was a stranger. I'm fearful and suspicious. My suspicion may turn out to be correct, but I can also, through my projecting my fear, create an atmosphere that is hostile. So I think suspicion of strangers is another way that enemies can be created. Europeans who came to this continent, how many years ago? 500 years ago now? Did this.
1900. Europeans came in the 1900s, some of the earliest. German, Russian, someone right at the 1840s.
Well, I guess I was talking about Columbus and in the. Isn't it the 1492, yeah. It's coming up quickly in a couple of years, the 500th anniversary of that. But those people automatically assumed that these strange-looking Native Americans were hostile and aggressive, projecting onto them the hostility that they themselves had. So the slightest incident, they attacked with swords and muskets, what we would call today a preventative strike. And in retaliation then, and in their own self-protective desire to not be violently overtaken, Indians at time became real enemies, and the Europeans then felt vindicated and said, these people really are savages. They're just as bad as we thought they were. So you can see how all of this kind of stuff that I've been talking about tends to escalate. It escalates because it's socially reinforced. enemy thinking, scapegoating, projecting, stereotyping, suspicion of strangers, all of that escalates because it goes unchallenged. Other people around me start thinking the same way, and none of us tend to associate with people we've characterized as different or strange. We don't hang around strangers or people who are opposed to our beliefs very often. So all of this is socially reinforced. As all of that escalates, it leads ultimately to what we call dehumanization. And this is really the point of what I'm trying to say, that all of this builds up to dehumanization, where the stranger or the enemy ceases to really be fully human and becomes only an object to be eliminated. And this, in my mind, is the only way in which we can reach the stage of full-scale war, when it's only through dehumanizing the enemy that we can kill them. And we have to somehow superimpose a variety of dehumanizing faces onto the enemy to allow us to kill them without guilt. We cannot kill real people with real families, people who are like us, because that's murder. We must first transform them into something that's less than human, and then it becomes patriotism. And if any of you have studied anything about military psychology, it's the biggest task is to convert an act of murder into an act of patriotism, and that's done through a dehumanizing process. I wanted to just show a 7 or 8 minute clip from a videotape called Faces of the Enemy that talks about this very well, and I think it has connections to our interpersonal lives as well. But let me just roll this, and I want to say that the person who you'll be seeing talking right at the beginning, he's not introduced, he's a, this is right in the middle of the videotape, he's a Vietnam veteran who comes back and then years later decides that he needs to deal with that experience and go back to Vietnam and figure out what all that is about for himself. Oh, I didn't put the videotape in.
They saw me as their enemy, I saw them as mine. And there was nothing I could do about it in those circumstances. Part of that feeling of feeling trapped into having to see other human beings as abstractions is why I wanted to go back and try to find these guys now when the guns were silent and the war was over. I had to meet those enemies, not as abstractions, but as individuals, as real human beings. And I wanted them to meet me. And maybe this way I could bring the war to an end. I could make some sort of personal peace. When I went back to my old battalion base and was sort of looking for it, I met a woman who was walking down the road. And I stopped and talked to her. And I said, well, what did you do during the war? She said, well, I was with the Viet Cong in this village. I said, oh, well, what was that like? She said, oh, it was very difficult. The Marines, this base, you know, they bombed us. I said, well, I was here then. She said, oh, very interesting. And then I said, what, are you married? She said, well, my husband was killed in the war. And I said, well, when? And she told me that he was killed at exactly the time that I was patrolling through the village where he was killed. So I said, well, I might have killed your husband. My men and I might have killed your husband. And she didn't blink. She just looked back at me and she sort of smiled and said, but that was during the war. The war is over now. Life goes on. And when I met some Viet Cong who fought against me around this particular area, what I saw was that these guys had been on the opposite side of the battlefield, and there's no greater gulf between men than the gulf of the battlefield, had been very much like me. If they'd been out there in the mud just as I had, if they missed their loved ones just as I had, that they sometimes had wanted to go home just as I had. And then we have more in common, in fact, than we had that which divided us.
You say you went back and you were surprised that they had girlfriends, but you were 26 when you went. You weren't a kid and you
24.
Were 24, excuse me. And you you've been to Oxford, I mean, you are very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you know at that time? Why didn't you?
Well, because it's very simple. When you're out there in the mountains or in the jungle and you get attacked, the people attacking you are not, in your mind, the sort of people you go out and have a beer with. I mean, you don't think Miller time. You think he, they, pronouns are trying to kill me, and it becomes something very, very different. It's only in the aftermath of battle. And it's only if you, for example, when you see a dead soldier, a dead enemy soldier, and maybe he's got letters or a picture, and then that sort of melancholy comes over you, that realization that this is my brother that's dead here. You were trained as a soldier to see the enemy as an obstruction. You have to. I mean, the soldier's most powerful weapon is not his rifle, but it's the idea of the enemy.
So let's see what kind of people these Japanese really are. First, let's examine a typical Japanese soldier. His average height is 5 feet 3 inches. His average weight, 117 pounds. He and his brother soldiers are as much alike as photographic prints off the same negative.
Why is it in every war the enemy is seen as less than human, as faceless, as an animal, as a monster? The image of the enemy is not only the soldier's most powerful weapon, it's society's most powerful weapon. It enables people in mass to participate in acts of violence they would never consider doing as individuals.
Wherever rats turn up, they spread annihilation throughout the land, destroying property and food supplies. This is how they disseminate disease, pestilence, leprosy, typhus, cholera, dysentery. Just like the Jews among mankind, rats represent the very essence of malicious and subterranean destruction. These faces are a striking refutation of the liberal theory that all who bear the human countenance are equal.
Facilitates killing. Any of us called in that type of a situation can't face the fact that we're killing a human being like you and I. That would be unbearable for most people. So therefore, in various ways, you have to feel you're exterminating someone who is less than you. And at the bottom level there, animals or vermin. The dominant image was the demonic enemy. The Japanese made them literally demons. Roosevelt, Churchill, Chiang Kai-shek have trampled the peoples of Asia. This was very hard for Westerners to appreciate. We say these are crazy people, they're robots, they've been brainwashed, and in fact, if you try to see it through Japanese eyes, they were told they were liberating Asia, and by the end of the war, they were told they were defending the homeland against a demonic foe. When the Japanese stereotyped the Anglo-American enemy, they often did it through the leaders. Whereas we went after the people and they were either buck-toothed, horn-rimmed glasses, or else the animal, the vermin.
Why not use dehumanizing images? We are talking about a time in the war when their atrocities were revealed to have been about as inhuman as anything that we can imagine. So what's wrong with that imagery?
By the end of the war in the Pacific, it was absolutely clear that the Japanese were defeated. Nobody anticipated a Japanese victory. And it was in that last year that we had millions, we're talking not about thousands or tens of thousands, we're talking about hundreds of thousands and millions of deaths. And the question is, why were not the different antagonists in the conflict, why were they not able to step back and somehow say that, look, the war is clear, the outcome of the war is clear, let's try to save as many lives as possible. And one of the reasons that they were not able to do so was because each side had depicted the other as a foe who would not surrender, or a foe who was so demonic, if they come into our country, they will commit atrocities against the population. It became very difficult to go against such images.
This is America. America. Where we make war with machines. Where we make justice for the soldiers of Japan who toss Chinese babies on their bayonets. Justice for the soldiers of Japan, buried Chinese men and women alive, tortured and starved and murdered American prisoners of war. Justice for these men who would be committing these same crimes today in San Francisco, Chicago, and Pittsburgh, New York, or any town. But America has the answer. Every forging kills a Jap. Every tank kills a Jap. Every gun kills a Jap.
So we move on to wiping out cities in Germany with the RAF and the Allies, then in Japan, where the Americans, for the first time in Japan, adopt this as a basic strategy of wiping out the civilian.
We can go on with that. It's an excellent videotape, but I want to move on to what I promised the title would be, is to talk about what we might do with enemies. Just for your information, in the back there are more pictures from the book called Faces of the Enemy that I brought with me, Reflections of the Hostile Imagination by Sam Keen, and I brought some of those along where you can really see that if you look, you can find all sorts of archetypes that are used over and over and over again throughout different wars, that even as the wars change, we have the same sorts of images of enemies, and just about all of our countries use those images. But I want to now move to what we might do, and this isn't something that you do really in 20 minutes, and maybe I'll talk about this a little bit more next week if some of you are going to be around, but basically I think that the obvious point for us as people of faith and as Christian people, our task is to demythologize and to humanize the enemy, to refuse to project onto the enemy what we believe them to be without really studying them, refusing to be part of the dehumanizing process that finally makes the enemy less than human and therefore easier to hate. And I believe this is true on the individual level and on the corporate level, our role as citizens in this country, that in whatever way possible, to refuse to be a part of the dehumanizing process. The Bible calls us to break down the dividing walls of hostility and enmity. Three basic ways that I think that happens on an initial level. Again, think of this individually and on a national level. The first would be understanding. We need to know the enemy, no matter how different their customs, their language, their ways of acting. We need to keep reminding ourselves in as many ways as possible that they are human beings, caught up in a process that we don't particularly like, but basically flesh and blood as we are. If I myself am sometimes angry, depressed, frustrated, or fearful, maybe I can understand how my enemy is that way as well. If I look at the world through my own perspective, accepting my interpretation as reality, then my enemies probably do the same thing. They may not hear what I say in the way I mean it. They might read motives in me which I don't have. So it's important to listen to the enemy for a couple reasons. One, simply to understand what's going on, to get a better understanding of why they're acting the way they are. And secondly, it's important to understand, listen to the enemy, because
what the enemy says about me is important, because the enemy can be an important mirror. Sometimes we see what we've repressed. We come to a greater understanding of how we're seen from afar. So I think that that's particularly important. And my basic rule of thumb would be to look with suspicion on the rhetoric or the propaganda of my own side, and look with compassion to the reasons of the enemy, and not simply to be duped by them, but I think in that way we get a good mirror of ourselves. Second to understanding would be focusing. As we continue to get to know the enemy, we also need to have we need to focus. We know that there's a better chance of solving the conflict if we concentrate our energies on the present problem and not always on past offenses. If we're able to keep our attention on specific issues that divide us now, rather than sort of roaming over the whole broad past of the relationship and the hostility, I think there's a better chance of working things out. In other words, there may be a terribly unjust or hostile relationship, but if we're always looking at the larger picture, the solution to the immediate problem becomes more difficult. So taking steps, focusing, building confidence in the process paves the way to broader solutions. Martin Luther King talked about the concept of forgiveness in this way. To illustrate focusing, King said, "Forgiveness does not mean putting a false label on an evil act. It means rather that the evil act no longer remains as a barrier to the relationship." So in other words, you don't ignore the past, but you decide finally that what has happened will not stand in the way of moving forward. And I really believe at a certain point in a relationship, whether this is individual or national, again, you have to decide what you want. If you want reconciliation, you need to take some steps to reconciliation comes through unilateral steps. I really believe that it doesn't come bilaterally. Someone has to very unfairly, unilaterally, and riskily step out and make the first step. And the last is negotiating, which is the hardest. It's the most difficult to talk about. It involves back and forth communication, obviously, with the enemy, to hammer out some sort of solution that we can both live with. It can start very quickly, as soon as we meet the enemy, or it can take years and years and years, depending on the two sides' willingness to negotiate or the readiness. If the other side refuses to join in dialogue, we have a variety of methods of persuasion available to us, a whole array of what I would call nonviolent techniques for bringing about negotiation. And nonviolence is something that we don't know very much about. We think of it as powerlessness, but it's important for us to understand nonviolence as a form of power. It's not passive, but an active force. Those who say that the other side only listens to strength, usually they have physical strength in mind, but there is other sorts of power. There's inner power, spiritual energy, wholeness of character. I think those are far more effective than physical strength in negotiating with enemies, and we need to explore that a little bit more as Christian people, because I think we have a specific calling from the gospel. Dan was talking about it this morning and in his Bible study during this week, that we are really called to turn the world upside down against the society's norms, and to be agents of reconciliation through love of enemy. And that's one of the most unique parts of, I think, our gospel, is love of enemy. And don't confuse us with liking, because I'm not advocating that we necessarily like our enemies. But the point is not to be so dominated by ill feelings, but to be able to somehow rise above those and to look to the humanity of the enemy and to see that of God in each person, no matter how they're behaving. And love of enemy, I think we think of that as being quite naive, but I don't think it is if we look closely at what that means. Not only not doing harm to someone, but meeting their physical needs intentionally. Not only not hating them, but praying for them, blessing them. Not only not striking out at them, but accepting suffering for one's stance on behalf of justice, and being willing to
accept that if we're to listen and follow Jesus' way. I think it's terribly important for us to learn more about it. I want to hand out one thing about that explains a little bit more about nonviolence, and then I want to open it up and just ask people about their own experiences with enemies and what has happened. But let me hand these out. The reason I decided to do this is because one of the reasons I assumed that a number of people were at the Bible study this week, and Dan referred to the four different groupings of people that were around in Jesus' time. And those were the Zealots, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. And I was struck by the way in which the four, at the top of this page, the four general ways that we normally think of responding to conflict can be found in the groups that were around in Jesus' time. When you look at fight, armed revolt, those were the Zealots who believed that they could bring about justice really through a bloody revolution. They were the most tenacious in wanting justice, but they also were committed to doing that through retaliation or violent rebellion. Flight would be similar, I think, to the Essenes, who are, you know, a large amount of evidence now that there was a group of people living as escapists, more or less, trying to live a pure separatist life and really removed from the dirty business of politics and conflict. Neutrality would be similar to, I would say, the Pharisees' position of being very concerned about spiritual things, proper order, legalistic, but perhaps not involved in political change, did very little to oppose Roman rule. Compromise, and I use compromise more in the negative sense of that word, not in the, I know there has to be compromise in the positive sense, but more like capitulation, I think, would represent the Sadducee position that went beyond the Pharisees and actually cooperated with the authorities and in exchange got some rewards for that. They were the realistic people that, you know, they wanted to figure out how to survive in a difficult situation. Nonviolence and love of enemy really means, somehow I think we think that nonviolence means you have to say no to that fight option, and that nonviolence is some combination of those other three. What I am saying is nonviolence, you have to say no to all of those and say none of the above. They're none of those things, but it's something completely different. It's an active force all of its own. And alternatives, these alternatives come from a theologian named Walter Wink, who writes in his book Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa, incredibly important book, where he points out that what Jesus was pointing to was a whole different way of life, and he just lists some of these that he feels come from the gospel, of a way in which, both on a personal level and on a national, international level, is a way to deal with enemies that both maintains one's sense of dignity but also confronts injustice, with the possibility that perhaps the enemy might be converted and might become just as well. So I just throw that out to you as a way of introducing you in a very limited way to nonviolence, that there are other options besides fight, flight, neutrality, and compromise, the four ways that we normally think of dealing with enemies. Let me stop here. We have about 15 minutes, maybe for 10, 15 minutes for conversation. I would just be interested either in any response you have to what I've said, or if you have a specific instance where you've been able to deal with an enemy either successfully or unsuccessfully, I think that would make some good conversation. So open it up. Yeah?
Hi, certainly. I hadn't thought about this when you were giving your meditation, but it's just right now I'm reminded of an incredibly intense and fortunate brief conflict that I had years ago with my father when I had recently become a Christian and he was not. And I was on a visit back east with him, and suddenly he engaged me in a series of rapid-fire accusatory questions about my faith. linking me with all the bad things he could think of that Christians in his mind stood for. And I became, for that brief period of time, an enemy to him and he to me.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have to say that I felt at that time that I was, that the Holy Spirit undertook for me. I was so startled by the attack and unprepared for it that I kind of went into a neutral mode, I felt, and just kind of cowered and hid out for that brief period and simply, you know, tried to answer only what was absolutely necessary of the questions that he was aiming at me and then just shutting up. Until it sort of passed, it was kind of the wave that passed over me, and then things kind of took, kind of went back to normal. That's really the only time I can think of where there was an active sense of, since I've been a Christian, of attack. And in that time, I didn't know what to do. I just sort of, as I say, cowered and waited. God kind of got me through it without any huge fireworks, but it was scary.
Yeah. And I don't mean to say that there's necessarily an answer for each of those situations, because there may not be, but I think we've not done a very good job as Christians of looking at the gospel and saying, no, how does this apply to my life when I'm in a situation like that? Does, you know, what sense does turning the cheek make? And do we understand what turning the other cheek means? I mean, in the Bible, we think of it as a fight, a fist fight, and it really isn't, because turning the other cheek would be if I think it goes, if someone tries to hit you on your right cheek, which means that it really would have to be a backhanded slap, which is much closer to an insult than to a fist fight. So they were talking about a situation of degradation and insult. To turn the other cheek was to simply maintain your dignity and humanness and say, you know, try again. Your first effort did not succeed. I'm a human being and I'm your equal. If you'd like to hit me on the left cheek with your full force, you're welcome to do that, but you will not take away my dignity. I mean, that was sort of the sense that turning the other cheek had in that time. It was not simply something passive, but it's an effort to maintain one's dignity. I'm reminded, when you talked about a father, a story that Mary Schramm writes about in Extravagant Love, which talks about nonviolence. It's in the bookstore. She talked about her friend Judy Essman, who had a very strained relationship with her father later in life. Her father really became almost a tormentor for her. Never hugged her hello or said, I miss you, when she left, and had a long period of estrangement, and never understood what had happened between them. And one day, Judy traveled to see her father, and other friends were there, and it was difficult. They were all the same old patterns, and they weren't able to reconcile. And she was just not able to get past this cold, unloving attitude. And in frustration, Judy just sort of left for home. And she had been driving for an hour, and she said at one point she realized that there was another presence with her in the car, and she had been crying so hard that she really didn't notice, but she sensed someone saying to her, stop the car and call your father. And she literally did that. She pulled over the road and found a phone booth, and the last thing that she really wanted to do was to call her father. She was so angry, but then she started thinking of the good things that had happened to her, where he had been present, and that she knew she loved him deeply. And so she saw a phone booth and called, and she asked a friend to get on the other extension so that they could hear what she was saying. And she began to tell him how she remembered the good times and what people liked about him and admired about her were the same things that they liked about him and what she had learned from him. And his response was, big deal. So why are you calling me now? And she said, to tell you that the gifts you gave me can never be taken away from me, and the gifts that you gave me are what I share with others, and I'll always be grateful for them. And his response was, I don't like you, and I wish we could be separated, and there's nothing between us anymore. And she said, you're right, sadly, but I just wanted to tell you these things. And he said, thanks for nothing, and hung up, and that was the last conversation that they had. He died several weeks later, but she felt like what she had said really released him to die, that she needed to say those things, he needed to hear them. There wasn't really reconciliation, but it released her to live as a person to say those things and to be reconciled. So I say that because not all stories end out positively, but there is a way somehow to break through, at least for one person, chasms that develop. Yeah.
What did you say the author's name was?
Mary Schramm, Extravagant Love, A Gospel Gift for Disarming the Heart. It's more about personal nonviolence. And the other book was called Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa, where Walter Wink really makes a case that that there is a way to nonviolently resist terrible oppression such as apartheid through nonviolence, through loving the enemy. And he calls it Jesus' third way. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
I have a memory of speaking to a teenage Lutheran youth group of about 50 students on this issue, and I asked them if they would help me draw an Arab on the blackboard. I said, you just give me characteristics of Arabs and I'll draw it. And I came out with the meanest slant-eyed, big nose, teeth showing, bullets across the front, machine gun, and all I said was Arab. Yeah. And I just told, it just really hit me, who is teaching, is our next war going to be to over oil fields in the Near East, and are young people somehow being trained to be ready to be demonized people in that area of the world?
Dan, do you think something like that is when you get a group that kind of radicalizes? What if you ask an individual one-on-one, he might not give you that same
picture. But I'm also aware of cartoons and the cartoons and the papers so often portray an Iranian.
So you can make it personal, help sometimes. You know.
That's why, global travel is important, and just interaction with people of other cultures is so important, because part of it is just simply ignorance, that we don't know much about people, and so we adopt culture stereotypes of them. I found this so true with, in Latin America, and, what we have done to Nicaragua, and people are unaware of what's happening down there, and we have all sorts of assumptions about Central American people and why there's poverty, and the same is true in other parts. But particularly this Mideast situation is what I was trying to say last night a little bit, and trying to show the Palestinian perspective, because it's not often seen that these people are suffering. Jews have also suffered. These people have much more in common with each other than they have separating them.
I just think that there's so much in the media that stimulates that kind of thing. Because I heard somebody talking the other day about the flight, was it 503 that went down.
Right.
What are we going to do to retaliate? I mean, the media keeps talking about this. I went back to graduate school 3 years ago, and I noticed so much more difference, because there's so much cutthroat competition, so that your classmates end up being your enemies if they outdo you, if you're trying to get something. Mm-hmm. And I think it's getting more embedded in our culture, and it's real frightening to me.
I think that's where it's helpful to try to look for other models, and to be influenced by other models that don't see that same sense of power coming from the ability to retaliate, and then actually to become your oppressor in the process. One quote that I want to read, and maybe this could be to end, because I know the bell's going to ring momentarily, but it's from Martin Luther King during the Civil Rights era, and I think he speaks to this about retaliation, or the sometimes how we want to retaliate, but perhaps there's more power in accepting suffering, but at the same time combating injustice.